"The next lot is the slave Jiri," Hop told them, reading from his notes. "He is, as you see, another fine, strong specimen."
500 guilders, growled the buzzard,
and glared at the other buyers, as if daring them to bid at their peril. But without the governor's wife to compete against, the burghers of the colony were bolder. "On to 100, sang out a merchant of the town. "On to 100 more, called a wagoner in a jacket of leopard skins. The bidding went quickly to 1,500 guilders, with only the wagoner and the buzzard in the race.
"Damn and blast the clod,"
Cumbrie muttered, and turned his head to catch the eye of his bosun, who, with three of his seamen, hovered beside the rear wheel of the carriage. Sam Bowles nodded, and his eyes gleamed. With his men backing him, he sidled through the press until he stood close behind the wagoner.
1,600 guilders, roared the buzzard, "and be damned to ye!"
The wagoner opened his mouth to push upwards and felt something prick him under the ribs. He glanced down at the knife in Sam Bowles' gnarled fist, closed his mouth, and blanched white as a baleen.
"The bid is against you, Mynheer Tromp," Hop called to him.
But the wagoner scurried away across the parade, back towards the town. Kimati and Matizi were both knocked down to the buzzard for well under 1,000 guilders each. The other prospective buyers in the crowd had seen the little drama between Sam and the wagoner, and none showed any further interest in bidding against Cumbrie. All three slaves were dragged away by Sam Bowles' shore party towards the beach. When Matizi struggled to escape, a shrewd crack over his scalp with a marlin spike quieted him, and with his mates he was shoved into the longboat and rowed out to where the Gull lay anchored at the edge of the shoals.
"A successful expedition for both of us, my lord," Katinka smiled at the buzzard. "To celebrate our acquisitions, I hope you will be able to dine with us at the residence this evening."
"Nothing would give me greater pleasure, but alas, madam, I was lingering only for the sail, and the chance of picking up a few prime seamen. Now my ship lies ready in the bay, and the wind and the tide bid me away."
"We shall miss you, my lord. Your company has been most diverting. I hope you will call on us and remain a while longer when next you round the Cape of Good Hope."
"There is no power on this earth, no storm, ill wind, or enemy, which could prevent me doing so," said Cumbrie, and kissed her hand.
Cornelius Schroeder glowered. He could not stand to see another man lay a finger on this woman who had come to rule his existence. As the buzzard's feet touched the deck of the Gull, he shouted to the helm,
"Geordie, my lad, prepare to weigh anchor and get under way."
Then he singled out Sam Bowles. "I want the three negroes on the quarter-deck, and swiftly." As they were ranged before him, he looked them over carefully.
"Does any one of your three heathen beauties speak God's own language?"
he asked, and they stared at him blankly.
"So it's only your benighted lingo, is it?"
He shook his head sadly.
"That makes life much harder."
"Begging your pardon," Sam Bowles tugged obsequiously at his Monmouth cap. "I know them well, all three of them. We was shipmates together, we was. They're playing you for a patsy. They all three speak good English." Cumbrie grinned at them with murder in his eyes.
"Ha! You belong to me now, my lovelies. From the tops of your woolly heads to the pink soles of your great flat feet. If you want to keep your black hides in one piece, you'll not play games with me again, do you hear me?"
And with a swipe of his huge hairy fist, he sent Jiri crashing to the deck.
"When I talk to you, you'll answer clear and loud, in sweet English words. We're going back to Elephant Lagoon, and for the sake of your health, you're going to show me where Captain Frankie hid his treasure. Do you hear me?"
Jiri scrambled back onto his feet.
"Yes, Captain Loddy, sir. We hear you. You are our father."
"I'd rather have lopped off my own spigot with a blunt spade than father the likes of one of you with it."
The buzzard grinned at them.
"Now get ye up on the main yard and clap some canvas on her."
And he sent Jiri on his way with a flying kick in the backside. Katinka sat in sunlight, in a protected corner of the terrace, out of the wind, with Cornelius Schroeder beside her. At the serving table, Sukina poured the wine with her own hands and carried the 2 glasses to the luncheon table, with its decorations of fruit and flowers from Slow John's gardens. She placed a tall glass with a spiral stem in front of Katinka, who reached out and caressed her arm lightly.
"Have you sent for a new slave?" she asked with a purr in her voice. "Aberley is being bathed and fitted with a uniform as you ordered, mistress," Sukina answered softly, as if unaware of the other woman's touch. However, Schroeder had seen it, and it amused Katinka to watch him frown with jealousy. She raised her glass to him and smiled over the rim. "Shall we drink to a swift voyage for Lord Cumbrae?" "Indeed," he lifted his glass. "A short, swift voyage to the bottom of the ocean for him and all his countrymen." "Oh, my dear Colonel," she smiled, "how droll. But softly now. Here comes my latest plaything." Two green jackets from the castle escorted Aberley onto the terrace. He was dressed in a pair of tight-fitting black trousers and a white cotton shirt, cut full to encompass his broad chest and massive arms. He stood silently before her. Katinka switched into English. "In future you will bow when you enter my presence, and you will address me as mistress. And if you forget, I will ask Slow John to remind you. Do you know who Slow John is?"
"Yes, mistress," Aberley rumbled, without looking at her.
"Oh, good. I thought you might be tiresome, and that I would have to have you broken and tamed. This makes things easier for both of us." She took a sip of the wine, then looked him over slowly with her head on one side. "I bought you on a whim, and I have not decided what I shall do with you. However, Governor Kleinhans is taking his coachman home with him when he sails. I will need a new coachman." She turned to Colonel Schroeder. "I have heard that these Negroes are good with animals. Is this your experience also, Colonel?"
"Indeed, mevrouw.
Being animals themselves, they seem to have a rapport with all wild and domestic beasts." Schroeder nodded and studied Aberley unhurriedly. "He is a fine physical specimen, but of course one does not look for intelligence in them. I congratulate you on your purchase." "Later I might breed him with Sukina," Katinka mused. The slave girl went still, but her back was turned so that they could not see her face. "It might be diverting to see how the black blood mingles with the gold." "A most interesting mixture," Schroeder nodded. "But are you not worried that he may escape? I saw him fight on the deck of the Standfastigate, and he is a truculent savage. A leg iron might be suitable costume for him, at least until he has been broken in."
"I do not think I need to go to such pains," Katinka said.
"I was able to observe him at length during my captivity. Like a faithful dog, he is devoted to the pirate Courtney, and even more so to his brat. I believe he would never try to escape while either of them is alive in the castle dungeons. Of course he will be locked in the slave quarters at night with the others, but during working hours he will be allowed to move around freely to attend to his duties."
"I am sure you know best, mevrouw, but I for one would never trust such a creature," Schroeder warned her.
Katinka turned back to Sukina.
"I have arranged with Governor Kleinhans that Fredericus is to teach Aberley his duties as a coachman and driver. The Standfastigate will not sail for another 10 days. That should be ample time. See to it immediately."
Sukina made the gracious Oriental obeisance. "As mistress commands," she said, and beckoned for Aberley to follow her. She walked ahead of him down the pathway to the stables, where Fredericus had drawn up the coach, and Aberley was reminded of the posture and carriage of the young virgins of his own tribe. As little girls, they were trained by their mothers, carrying the water gourds balanced on their heads. Their backs grew straight, and they seemed to glide over the ground, as this girl did.
"Your brother, Arthuda, he sends you his hat. He says that you are his tiger orchid still."
Sukina stopped so abruptly that walking behind her, Aberley almost collided with her. She seemed like a startled sugar bird perched on a protea bloom on the point of flight. When she moved on again, he saw that she was trembling.
"You have seen my brother?" she asked, without turning her head to look at him. "I never saw his face, but we spoke through the door of his cell. He said that your mother's name was Ashleth, and that the jade brooch you wear was given to your mother by your father on the day of your birth. He said that if I told you these things, you would know that I was his friend."
"If he trusted you, then I also trust you. I too shall be your friend, Aberley," she agreed.
"And I shall be yours," Aberley said softly.
Oh, do tell me, how is Alsuda? Is he well? She pleaded. Have they hurt him badly? Have they given him to Slow John? Alsuda is puzzled. They have not yet condemned him. He has been in the dungeon 4 long months, and they have not hurt him. I give all thanks to Allah.
Sukina turned and smiled at him, her face lovely as the tiger orchid to which Alsuda had likened her.
I had some influence with Governor Kleinhans. I was able to persuade him to delay judgment on my brother. But now that he is going, I do not know what will happen with the new one. Ah, my poor Alsuda, so young and brave. If they give him to Slow John, my heart will die with him as slowly and as painfully.
There is one I love as you love your brother, Abelie rumbled softly. The two share the same dungeon.
I think I know the one of whom you speak. Did I not see him on the day they brought all of you ashore in chains and marched you across the parade? Is he straight and proud as a young prince?
That is the one. Like your brother, he deserves to go free.
Again Sukina's feet checked, but then she glided onwards.
What are you saying, Abri, my friend?
You and I together. We can work to set them free.
Is it possible? She whispered.
Alsuda was free once. He broke his jesses and soared away like a falcon.
Abberley looked up at the aching blue African sky.
With our help, he could be free again, and Gundwani with him.
They had come to the stable yard, and Fredericus roused himself on the seat of the carriage. He looked down at Abberley, and his lips curled back to show teeth discoloured brown by chewing tobacco.
How can a black ape learn to drive my coach and my 6 darlings?
He asked the empty air.
Fredericus is an enemy. Trust him not.
Sukina's lips barely moved as she gave Abelie the warning.
Trust nobody in this household until we can speak again.
As well as the house slaves and most of the furniture in the residence, Katinka had purchased from Kleinhans all the horses in his string and the contents of the tack room. She had written him an order on her bankers in Amsterdam. It was for a large sum, but she knew that her father would make good any shortfall. The most beautiful of all the horses was a bay mare, a superb animal, with strong, graceful legs and a beautifully shaped head. Katinka was an expert horsewoman, but she had no feeling or love for the creature beneath her, and her slim, pale hands were strong and cruel. She rode with a Spanish curb that bruised the mare's mouth savagely, and her use of the whip was wanton. When she had ruined a mount, she could always sell it and buy another. Despite these faults, she was fearless and had a dashing seat. When the mare danced under her and threw her head against the agony of the whip and the curb, Katinka sat easily and looked marvellously elegant. Now she was pushing the mare to the full extent of her pace and endurance, flying up the steep path, using the whip when she faltered or when it seemed as though she would refuse to jump a fallen tree that blocked the pathway. The horse was lathered, soaked with sweat, as though she had plunged through a river. The froth that streamed from her gaping mouth was tinged pink with blood from the edged steel of the curb. It splattered back onto Katinka's boots and skirt, and she laughed wildly with excitement as they galloped out onto the saddle of the mountain. She looked back over her shoulder. Schroeder was 50 lengths or more behind her. He had come by another route to meet her in secret. His black gelding was labouring heavily under his weight, and though Schroeder used the whip freely, his mount could not hold the mare. Katinka did not stop at the saddle, but with the whip and the tiny needle-sharp spur under her riding habit, goaded the mare onward and sent her plunging straight down the far slope. Here a fall would be disastrous, for the footing was treacherous and the mare was blown. The danger excited Katinka. She revelled in the feel of the powerful body beneath her and of the saddle leather pounding against her sweating thighs and buttocks. They came slithering off the scree slope and burst out into the open meadow beside the stream. She raced parallel with the stream for 1/2 league, but when she reached a hidden grove of silver-leaf trees, she reined in the mare in 12 lunges from full gallop to a wrenching halt. She unhooked her leg from over the horn of the side saddle, and in a swirl of skirts and laced underlinen dropped lightly to earth. She landed like a cat, and while the mare blew like the bellows of a smithy and reeled on her feet with exhaustion, Katinka stood, both fists clenched on her hips, and watched Schroeder come down the slope after her. He reached the meadow and galloped to where she stood. There he jumped from the gelding's back. His face was dark with rage. "That was madness, my frau," he shouted. "If you had fallen." "But I never fall, Colonel," she laughed in his face. "Not unless you can make me." She reached up suddenly and threw both arms around his neck. Like a lamprey, she fastened on his lips, sucking so powerfully that she drew his tongue into her own mouth. As his arms tightened around her, she bit his lower lip hard enough to start his blood and tasted the metallic salt on her own tongue. When he roared with pain, she broke from his embrace and, lifting the skirts of her habit, ran lightly along the bank of the stream. "Sweet Mary, you will pay dearly for that, you little devil!" He wiped his mouth, and when he saw the smear of blood on his palm, he raced after her.